And welcome back to the Drive with Duff. The last lingering moments in this uncharacteristically dark universe of ours. I'm just talking about daylight saving time being over. I mean, it's tragic. Tragic, I tell you. Beryl Wiseman, the last angry man. I can't rage about this. Hey, Beryl, how you doing?
You don't believe in daylight savings time being over.
Oh, yes, absolutely. I believe in it 100%.
I think you should just, it's a matter of mind over matter. You remember what they asked Satchel Paige when he was 60 years old and still pitching? He said, didn't his body ache and didn't it bother him? He said, it's mind over matter. They said, what do you mean? He said, you don't mind, it don't matter.
Yeah.
I think, you know, James, you know, in your typically just joyous outlook on life, you should just assume the sun is shining.
I'm assuming the moon is out. I mean, it's all wonderful.
For you too.
So have you? Yeah, absolutely. So have you recognized Quebec as a nation yet?
You know, we're going to be talking about that. this nationhood garbage is really. I had a taste of it on Saturday, Jim. You know, we had that conference on Wednesday, a very successful conference about the status of women under Islamic regimes and what we as a nation of Canada, a part of the Western family of free nations, are willing to fight for as far as values. And there was a group of young men there who wanted to do a sort of Red Friday demonstration of support of our troops on Saturday, mm-hmm. where there was going to be another one of these wonderful conglomerations of groups who believe everybody has a right to be wrong, and they were going to march for peace in Afghanistan and all troops out. And this group of young men, university students, one was an ex-soldier who led them, wanted to just rally support for the troops. And he asked our help in getting the word out. So we did. And come Saturday morning, there we stood in the rain. I'll be going to this further on the show. And there weren't many people out. There certainly weren't as many people on the other side as was reported. And, of course, this is a last-minute thing, so it was only 15, 20 of us.
Yeah, yeah, I never heard
and
about it.
I heard about
your demo.
And then at the end of it, a reporter comes over from a Francophone radio station. That's about as far as I'll go, depending on what I decide to do about it. And she went to this young soldier and wanted him to comment. And he said, look, I organize it, but I'm not really good at talking to reporters. And they were talking in French. We were all talking in French. And she directed him to me. He directed her to me, sorry. And after a 5-minute discussion of the pros and cons of what Canada's role should be in the world and my normal line about how I think we should be involved with struggles for redemptive change abroad and relief of oppression, it was over, and, you know, we said, look, they can march, we can march, we're supporting the troops, and cars were driving by the way, honking support as the crowd was waving Canadian flags. Then, James, came a question. Out of nowhere, unrelated to anything, she says to me, a very refined-looking lady, by the way, not a kid, vous êtes juif, vous?
Oh,
and I said,
you got it.
And I said,
joking, my
she
God.
She asked me, for those who don't speak French, you're Jewish, you? I said, pourquoi? Toi, catholique, toi? You're Catholic, you. And I said, what the hell has that got to do with what we've been discussing? So she said to me she wanted context. And I said, what do you mean context? She said, well, the other group is being supported by the Canadian Islamic Congress and others. I said, yes. So what are you saying? An individual can't have their own opinion without the benediction of some collectivity? And if that's what Quebec nationhood is all about, submission of the individual's consequence to a collectivity, God help us.
God yes, Beryl, and go get him. Go get him, Tiger. Last angry man. Unleashed. Thank you very much to Chris Bunbury, to Margo Edwards, Melissa Wheeler, and everybody else for listening to The Drive with Duff on this Monday evening. Enjoy that darkness out there.
No accidents of geography. No bloodlines of descent can make a people a nation. Nations are built on what you believe, what you're willing to fight for, the causes you're willing to die for, not what you hate, but what you love, not what you stand against, but what you stand for. Nations aren't made up of populations that are willing to live in quiet desperation, abdicating any individual consequence for something from Big Daddy at the state, as they would on a personal level, to some overbearing spouse or parent. You stand on your own feet, and you stand for something that's valuable. Last week, the Institute for Public Affairs, which I run, held a conference on questions of values. And there was courage in that room, not only from the speakers, women who had suffered under Islamic fundamentalism, under cruel, oppressive regimes, but the courage of that room that brought together Jews and Christians and Muslims and Greeks and Sikhs and Copts and every conceivable kind of person, knowing that there would be the possibility of danger, but knowing also that to live a life, you've got to live a life breathing free. After the conference, I was approached by a group of young men, one in particular, an ex-soldier who's now studying. And he was very concerned about the fact that this past Saturday was going to see another demonstration similar to the one on August the 6th, the famous Hezbollah rally, another group of defenders of people's and states' right to be wrong who are going to march against Canadian participation in Afghanistan. And he wanted to do something. He wanted to do anything just to show support for the best and the bravest of our young people who are over there. And he knew it was the last minute, but he asked us to send a message out through our network, however many people would show up. So there we were, Saturday morning. The rain searing our faces like icicles falling off a roof ledge. It was incessant and unforgiving. But there we stood, this little band of brothers and sisters in one of Montreal's busiest downtown corners, under an angry gray October sky. We stood there because this young man and others wanted to purge themselves of some anger, purge themselves against these groups that consistently try to question Canadian consequence. There's been so many marches for so many retrograde causes in Montreal these days, it's hard to keep track. But this was yet another group that was worth opposing. And as it turned out, only a few joined us on that corner. It was late. So there we were, waving Canadian Quebec flags and holding up signs calling on passers-by to support our troops and stand with the free. Not bad messages, those. A lot of people seemed to agree as the passing drivers honked their support. We were few in number. And though we had arrived a half hour before the other side, we knew they had rented trucks and sound equipment and had the benefit of weeks of planning. A journalist had cautioned me that perhaps we shouldn't get involved, since if we were outnumbered, it would send a negative message. My feeling was, at least there would finally be another message heard. I also reminded him of what Emerson wrote, that one person resolute, abiding by truth, will rally a majority. May not happen in a day, but it'll happen, and this brave young man deserved our help. Well, the fates must have been watching over us, because though the other side outnumbered us, they certainly didn't put on an impressive display. The fierce rain kept many away. And cameras rolled on both sides of the street, and one or two reporters came and said that they'd be back. And then a funny thing happened on the way from the rally. We were approached by a reporter who immediately pounced on us and said, why are we opposed to peace? And we explained that we weren't opposed to peace. This young man who had organized the rally didn't feel comfortable talking to reporters, and we were speaking in French, and everybody's comfortable in French, but he didn't really know or how to send a message across, and he asked the reporter to speak to me. And after a five-minute discussion about how we were standing here for our soldiers, we were standing here for freedom. We were standing here to show that Canada has a responsibility as a G7 nation that takes so much in human and material resources from the third world, where so many live under oppression, that we have a responsibility to shoulder our fair share of a burden in offering the oppressed millions there some hope, that if this country was not involved in the transcendent struggles for redemptive change, then our own fleeting encounters with social justice at home is just so much self-delusion, that our new prime minister has given this nation a brave and bold vision, and we should follow it. There was no talk of the recent Middle East war, Iraq, or any parochial particularities. We simply talked of the need to support Canada's newly restored pride and purpose in the international scene. We discussed the merits of the McNaughton mission. We spoke of the necessity of Canadians as members of the family of free peoples needing to guard against giving comfort to the enemies of freedom and compromising the survival and success of liberty. We described the little rally as a rally of conscience, similar to the Red Friday rallies in support of our forces that are held across the country, and that it was to our city's shame that there was no Red Fridays here. And that was it. That was the discussion. Then came the zinger. This reporter, very intelligent-looking, very refined-looking woman, asked me if I was a Jew. Out of nowhere. I snapped back, I'm a Canadian, and I'm a Democrat. And I don't define myself by religion. Why? Are you a Catholic? I wanted to know what possible reason she had for this question and why I'm so often asked my religion by so many, frankly, francophone reporters. Defensively, she replied it was for context. I asked, what context? And her answer was symptomatic of the social sickness that has made so many fey and feckless and so many so intolerant. She said that the, quote, peace marchers had groups such as the Canadian Islamic Congress participating and sponsoring. I asked, so what? We were there as free citizens. That was our title. That was our tie. She persisted. It was as if she could not understand that people can act out of individual initiative and character without the benediction of any group. Her face exhibited a recoil of bitter resentment, bordering on rage. It was as if I had mouthed a blasphemy so heinous as to make me an enemy of the people. She tried once again. And I said that there were 3 Jews out of a dozen or 15 people in his group. Does that make it a Jewish conspiracy? No, I said, we were not tied to any organizations, but the very fact that you ask, madam, shows that you have the age-old prejudice that considers so many outsiders, particularly Jews, as les autres, the others. Openly flustered and upset, she then abruptly terminated the interview and accused me of prejudging her, quickly disconnecting her tape recorder from the microphone and stuffing them both in her purse while reaching for an umbrella that I had been holding over her. In a hurry to cross the street, she turned from me, but I persisted in reminding her of one thing. The fact that she, a journalist, a member of a profession that should prize individualism and independence, could not accept that people can act without regard to any collectivity, and that that condition, that mental affectation was part of the disease destroying the society. So much has been surrendered to statocratic collectivist consensus that even freedom of thought, action, and assembly are suspect. So in this week, where we've spoken so much about nationhood and what constitutes a nation, I reminded her, and I would remind all our listeners, of what a Francophone senator once told me, that the real two solids in Quebec were not between Anglophones and Francophones, but between those Francophones that were the heirs of Papineau and Lafontaine and Laurier and Trudeau, and those others who were the heirs of the time of the Le Grand Noirceur, Abbé Grou, and Adrian Archon. And they have to reflect on which legacy they want. Because if song et langue, blood and language, were still the only litmus test of legitimacy, then there is no nation. And there can never be. Laurier's boast of a pluralist Quebec where, quote, it has been my great pride to be excommunicated by Roman priests and condemned by Protestant parsons, that boast of pluralism was betrayed day in and day out. And maybe it's time that we start to think about how Canada started. Nobody's got an automatic right to this place. Francophone settlement here was for an imperialist king, so was Anglophone settlement here. But one thing no nation can abide are the prejudices against any group or creed, because that's nothing but the swollen envy of pygmy minds. We'll be right back. Well, we're talking about nationhood earlier and in this half hour, and part of nationhood is having a citizenry understanding what's real and what's not, separating the wheat from the chaff. And one of our storehouses of reason and sanity in this country is our next guest. Dr. Timothy Ball was Canada's first PhD in climatology. He's president of the Friends of Science, and he's going to help us wade through a lot of the nonsense we've been hearing on environmental issues. Tim Ball, welcome and thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you, but I'll take that. Since we're talking about the truth, I'm not the president of the Friends of Science, so just to get that straight, but anyway.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, no problem. We've got to get everything straight if we're going to sort out the weather and the climate and all the extreme nonsense that's going on.
Absolutely. Now, you're just back from Ottawa. We're going to be talking about two issues. One that I wanted to talk with you last Thursday, and the time got cut short, which was the comparison of the two environmental packages between the Tories and Liberals. And the second, I'm sure you have a lot to say about Nicholas Stern's report today, which has been condemned by other quarters. And, of course, the funniest thing of all is that we're going to have to start our discussion in about 30 seconds because guess what? Here it's Holy Writ. We have to break for a traffic report, so we're gonna contribute to gas house emissions, to greenhouse emissions. Isn't that terrible?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and you know what? You could. It was interesting because they were saying if Britain shut down all the cars and all of their CO2 production, that China would replace it all within the next 13 months. And yet China's was not a part of Kyoto, wasn't involved in any of the, well, it was part of Kyoto, but it wasn't going to have to make any cutbacks.
I want to hammer this Kyoto point home, and you and I have done it before, and we're going to do it again in just 30 seconds. We'll be right back with Dr. Timothy Ball. So before I get all the environmentalists chasing me with the discussion I'm about to have with Dr. Timothy Ball, I wanted to apologize to some callers that were on the line that wanted to comment on my opening remarks. We had a slight technical glitch and sort of like almost an electrical short. So we would invite them to call back right after our discussion with Dr. Ball. Tim Ball, 1, 2, 3. When are Canadians going to understand, first of all, about Kyoto? Those who think that this is some kind of a saving grace, that all Kyoto is a right of nations like Canada that has a worse record than America to send a check over to Russia this year, $1.3 billion, to buy their tax credits because their economy's failing and they don't have what to pollute with. So we're actually paying for the right to pollute. What is it about this that Canadians don't get?
Well, the ordinary Canadian, we don't really know because their voice has never been put out there. But most of the world saw Kyoto for what it was, that it was a shell game of carbon credits, and it doesn't reduce the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere. And, of course, it also assumes that CO2 is a problem, which it isn't. It's not a pollutant. It's not a problem in the atmosphere. So I don't know how much longer it'll go on. And, of course, the other thing, Beryl, is that...
And people are building their political careers on this.
Oh, absolutely, of course. But, you know, H.L. Mencken once said that the whole aim of practical politics is to keep the populace alarmed and hence clamorous to be led to safety by menacing it with an endless series of hobgoblins, all of them imaginary.
Ah, Brother Ball, anybody who could quote Mencken to me is a man after my own heart. That's like Mark Twain's lies, damn lies, and statistics.
I've got to correct you on that. That was Benjamin Disraeli, a politician, who said that.
No, that was Twain. And he continued, by the way, he continued by saying statistics should not be supportive, they should be educative.
Well, that part's true. I would agree with you. But anyway, the Kyoto thing, you know, the only reason that it got approved was because Russia were blackmailed into signing it by the Europeans, who said, if you don't sign it, we won't support your joining the World Trade Organization. Most of the major producers of CO2, if that's the problem, were not part of it. Right? Americans didn't sign. India and China weren't required to reduce. And so it was just a farce. And the farce continues, the carbon credit trading. And by the way, Russia would have a hard time claiming their money from Canada now because their level of CO2 production has gone up by 11%. The only reason we'd have to pay them is because they had credits to sell.
Right, but we paid them last year.
Yeah. Well, now it looks like they don't have any if their latest figures are correct. So it's just a shell game. But Kyoto was all about transfer of wealth. It wasn't about global warming or anything else. And that's what people have to realize.
Now, you spend your time, a lot of your time, both with politicians and with media people.
Yeah.
So here comes the Conservative government with their environment package. And all of a sudden, a good part of the progressive, touchy-feely Canadian media naturally has to pounce on it because to them, it's an oxymoronic that a Conservative government can come up with an environmental package. And one of the things they didn't like was that the target year was 2050. How come nobody pointed out that the Liberal environmental package, the target date was 2050? And as a matter of fact, the Tory package moved the baseline up by 14 years from 1990.
Yeah, well, but of course, you know, it becomes about politics, not about the science or about the numbers, and that's the game with all of it.
The thing about the reporters. Why did they perpetuate the myths of in a lot of things, including smoking studies and a lot of these things where the science isn't real science? It's epidemiology. It's extrapolation of hypothetical statistical models.
Well, I can tell you that because most of the scientists, the media that I talk to, and particularly the CBC, are very left-wing in their views, and they're not even aware of it. They're doing a program on CBC Radio, and they wanted me to participate. Well, the actual emails that I got and the approach they wanted to take, for example, the first question to me was, well, who's paying you? And I went and looked at all their other programs and said, well, did you ask that question of anyone else? Even some people look like they're doing good, but actually
Tim, I don't know if you heard my intro, but I mean this is in another aspect something I went through on the weekend. I was at a Support Our Troops rally, and a Francophone reporter came over to me, and after talking for about 5 minutes on the merits of Afghanistan and the troop thing, all out of nowhere said, "Are you Jewish?"
It's
always like, who's behind this?
Yeah,
God forbid a Canadian should actually have independence of thought.
Well, exactly, and those are the boogeymen. You know, you play the race card, you play the paid by the oil and gas company card, you play the emotional card. Oh, the children are going to die. And of course, at that point, any rational debate and calm decision making is
out the window.
It's gone out the window. Yeah.
Tim Ball, please stay with us. We're taking a short break. We'll be right back. We're talking with Dr. Timothy Ball from Vancouver, Canada's first PhD in climatology, and we're getting some common sense on environmental issues. Tim, This report today, of course, Globe and Mail, the chattering class salon liberals at prayer, of course, in big point type, $7 trillion warning on global warming, and they're all concerned because it's coming from an economist. Meanwhile, buried in the story is the fact that Sir Nigel Lawson, a former Chancellor of the Exchequer of Great Britain, and seven other leading economists called it a misdirected exercise.
Yeah.
Who funds these kind of stuff?
Well, that one seems to be from the government there, because Blair, introduced it and spoke very strongly for it. But let me give you a quick, very quick overview. What's happening here is they're shifting their ground. See, they say the science is over, and you hear that all the time. The science is over. It's proven. No, it isn't. In fact, what's happening, they're losing the battle. Fundamental thing, they say if CO2 goes up, temperature goes up. But the ice core record shows exactly the opposite. The temperature rises before the CO2. So a fundamental assumption is wrong. Second, you'll notice that they've shifted from talking about global warming to climate change. It's all about climate change, even though the headline in the Globe is global warming, but the overall shift. Why?
The buzzword.
Because from 1998 to the present, the global temperature has been going down. Meanwhile, human production of CO2 continues to increase. The facts aren't even fitting the theory. So let's not talk about global warming. Let's talk about climate change.
And you've made the point in your own work that there have been periods in the past 75 years, never mind longer than that, where we've had more global warming than we've seen in the past 10.
Oh, yeah. The first half of the 20th century was more dramatic warming than we've had in the last 10. But what they're doing now is, so they're switching to climate change, which allows them then to say, oh, excessive cold is due to climate change or humans. Everything can be pointed the finger at humans. So now what they're doing is switching to economics, because that's, the old thing. It's the economic stupid. It's the economy stupid.
Right.
And so that's why they've got Stern involved. But there's a
Wait a minute. Did you say it's the stupid economists?
Well,
no, just kidding.
No, well, because I put them up there with the weather forecasters. You know, their forecasts are as bad as the weather forecasters. What they're trying to do is predict the tide by measuring one wave.
Okay, how have we got a problem with the famous ozone layer?
No. No, and in fact, the problem they've got with that is last year, the so-called thinning area, which is not a hole, it's just a thinning area, was much smaller, and they said, oh, this is due to the Montreal Protocol. This year, if the hole, or so-called hole, is larger than it's ever been. And the reason is because they've got record cold temperatures over the Antarctic. And so what they said last year has put them in trouble this year. And this keeps happening. Nature keeps throwing curves at them, and they keep avoiding them. And just to get back to the Stern thing, it's a very clever shell game again. You see, he did a risk analysis. he didn't do what an economist should do, and that is a cost-benefit analysis. And when you do cost-benefit analysis...
I have an economist friend who keeps telling me that all the time, as a matter of fact.
Well, exactly. So what Stern did was a risk analysis, not a cost-benefit analysis, and people like Mendelsohn did a cost-benefit analysis of warming, said, comes up with net benefits. And certainly for Canada, warming is a benefit. And so the other thing that he did was he took a worst-case scenario. He took an extreme scenario. He said that the warming is going to be 3 degrees in less than 50 years, which nobody is saying. Absolutely nobody. Even the most extreme models are not predicting that. And yet that's the basis on which he's making these statements in his risk analysis. And so when you look at what's behind it, what he's assuming again, it's just absolute rubbish.
We're going to take a short break, and I'm going to come back to you with one or two last questions about stuff that we have to address because we see it in our faces all the time.
Yep.
Montreal, we'll be right back. And we've been getting some plain speaking and common sense in the environment, on climate change, on global warming, a lot of debunking of myths from Dr. Timothy Ball, Canada's first PhD in climatology. And, Tim, I just wanted to keep you on to ask you one final question.
Sure.
If a politician wanted to be a leader, not a follower, not a panderer, what is the issue on the environment agenda that he should address in what they now like to talk about, sustainable development and sustainable lifestyle?
Well, I think the first thing is to establish a much better web of measurement and not to have more laws or regulations, but to simply implement and monitor the ones we already have. And so that's the first thing I would do. Canada's closed weather station, so we got less weather data now than we had in 1960. And so to try to say anything about what's going on is meaningless. So the first thing we need to do is make sure that we're getting good data. And the second thing is to calm the panic, calm the hysteria. You don't make good decisions under those circumstances. And the third thing is stop being bullied by the environmental groups, because we're being emotionally bullied by them, and that's got to stop. And so the fourth thing I would do is look at what we've done so far. Now, we spent $6 billion, according to the Environment Commissioner, Gelinas, and essentially wasted. It's changed nothing. That, of course, is where the money went from closing the weather stations. And in the meantime, we have achieved some better figures on air and clean air and clean water, but that's where we need to do more. And that was essentially what I think what the Conservatives were trying to do. The problem is I don't like the draconian way that they're going about it, of imposing fines and imposing things on people. I think it's far better to have positive incentives to change, not negative ones.
Dr. Timothy Ball from Vancouver, always a pleasure to have you on.
Thank you, Ro.
I don't know what it is, Montreal, and everybody listening on the World Wide Web, but I don't know, a lot of Canada's storehouse of reason seems to be out in Western Canada. And we're going from Vancouver to Edmonton now, and we're very pleased that Lauren Gunter could join us. Lauren, welcome.
Thank you.
So, Canada, you know, next to the environmentalists, the biggest marchers in this country, seems to be all these little groups that really believe that other cultures and other states have a right to be wrong. And my word, you know, if they're killing and if they're maiming and if they're blowing houses up, it must be something we in the West did wrong. And you've brought forth today a remarkable number that an average of 20 French police officers are injured each day in what the French police themselves call an intifada. Now, we've just been through a weekend where we've seen people marching across the country again, that Canada should leave Afghanistan and, you know, let the Taliban work things out. What does it take for Canadians just to look at the numbers?
I don't know. It's remarkable. First of all, I think one of the reasons that we are blind to all of this is that it's not happening here the way it is happening in the Parisian suburb. Now, that figure that you just quoted, that I quoted this morning,
yes,
is a daily occurrence and has been for nearly a year since the riots that went on, that got worldwide coverage last October, where there were 9,000 cars burned and almost 3,000 people arrested in nightly clashes with the police. But the thing that I found remarkable was there was an interview recently in, of all places, the Daily Telegraph in London, with the head of the French Policemen's Union, who said it never stopped. He said, a direct quote from him is that we are in a state of civil war with radical Muslims in the Paris suburbs.
And, you know, I got to tell you something. Most of my relatives live in France, and sometimes they're afraid to go into some of those areas where they used to go to visit restaurants or anything else. It's that bad on the streets.
Right. And as I pointed out this morning, it is not just Islam that's behind this. I mean, I really am a huge opponent and have been forever of large-scale housing projects, the big public housing projects
right.
that were put up in the 60s and 70s, because they're nothing but, well, the police out here call them breeding pens, because they don't mean that they're producing a lot of people. It means they produce a lot of crime,
right.
drug addiction, fatherlessness, violence, you name it, whatever kind of antisocial behavior you don't want. If you have a large-scale housing project, you're going to have that behavior in copious amounts. So it's the fact that the French economy is highly regulated, so it's been very slow to create new jobs, and immigrants are the people who feel that the most. But the police union and increasingly people in the interior ministry in France are also saying that, look, we're uncovering, we go into apartment buildings and break up a black market ring, or we catch some of the people who were burning cars on the street the night before, and we get all sorts of radical Muslim literature that says that the police are fair game, that French society is corrupt and decadent, and that you have a jihad duty to go out and try and convert France to Islam by the sword, and you've got to be worried about that sort of thing.
Lauren, be right back with you. We're just going to pay some bills. And we're talking to Lauren Gunter from Edmonton, National Post columnist, excuse me, about France's problem with radical Islam. And Lauren, I asked you earlier in the interview why Canadians don't get some of these figures, and you said, well, it hasn't happened here, but I'm wondering if there isn't a mental self-censorship or a mental block. I was speaking earlier about this Support Our Troops demonstration that I was at on the weekend, and a reporter comes over, and after discussing the issues, out of nowhere asks me if I'm a Jew, as if that is somehow relevant.
Yeah. Well,
so we may not have the physical violence, but we are doing violence to our pluralism as a society.
Well, we're certainly walking into it with a blindfold on. That's I think unquestionable, and a lot of it is that we've told ourselves for the last 30 or 40 years that we're a multicultural, tolerant society. So we don't want to believe that there's anything that's going to challenge that, that's going to make us break with
right.
that image of ourselves, and so we try to ignore what's going on around us. I mean, we've had instances where, for instance, in Calgary, where the local cable channel, the cable access channel, was used by fairly radical Afghanis to preach jihad against Canadian troops in Afghanistan. You know, it does happen. It's not to the point yet where 20 policemen a day are being injured, though, which is fortunate. But it can get to that point.
No, but you know what? I have a feeling it's at the point where 20 journalists a day, at least in eastern Canada, are shutting their mouths because, A, out of fear, and, B, they're really buying into the notion that some evil was done and there's a right to be wrong. Lauren, stay with us. I just want to take our lines are lighting up. Let me just take one call. Brian from NDG, you've been very patient. Thank you.
Yeah, Beryl. You know, I just wanted to first say that obviously that that journalist had never listened to you, or she would have realized how ridiculous her comment was. Now,
what astounded me was, why ask at all? This wasn't a demonstration about the Middle East. We were supporting our troops in Afghanistan.
Yeah.
It was astounding.
I know.
This is what I'm just talking to Lauren Gunther about. You know, we may not have the physical violence in Canada, but have we not done violence to our own spirits and to our own minds?
And you know what I also find astounding is that the current crop of federal politicians don't seem to realize that we didn't fight two referendums so they could come along and undo the result. The fact that
I would level those charges at the Liberals. I think the Prime Minister understands that very well. Where Ignatieff is getting this nation business, I have no idea. Isn't it time for someone, Lauren, Brian, someone to speak to Canada and say, look, guys, you know, the French colonized Canada for the King of France to get beaver pelts, which were like gold. 100 years later, the Brits come here. They kill the French and the Indians. They give a third of the company to the Hudson's Bay Company. We didn't reach maturity. When Laurie said in 1905, Canada answers to a higher destiny. That destiny and that maturity, the best of us was realized when we were involved in the world struggles for redemptive change. We realized that destiny at Vimy Ridge, at Dieppe, at Normandy, under the sons of the son of the Sinai, not by sitting in our little parochial corners trying to be everything to everybody.
It needs to be understood. I don't know how they could not realize this, but the fact that the separatists lost means that the majority of Quebecers see Canada as their nation. They need to understand that the separatists don't speak for all of Canada. They may have the loudest voice, but they don't even speak for the majority of Quebecers.
I hope you're right, Brian. Thanks for your call. Lauren, when you hear somebody like that saying that, and then you've got, you know, the Liberal Party raising the whole thing of nationhood again, how do you give people here hope?
Or in
Alberta. I mean, I know in Alberta you're ready to go anyway.
Well, you know, we're not now. It's funny how the one election can change your temperament for temporarily anyway. But the fascinating thing about Ignatieff and the nation, the whole nation labeling, is that out here we always have thought that the worst damage that's been done to Canada's unity is when the Liberals have been in power, because they've said, well, you know, Bourassa, for example, was far more dangerous
yep.
to the Constitution than any of the PQ premiers have been. And so we always get a chuckle out of the fact that people elect the Liberals in order to keep the country together, because they seem to be doing more damage than anyone else.
Lauren Gunter, as always, it just does my heart good to talk to you out there in Edmonton and Montreal, Canada, everybody who's listening. I like to leave everybody with one of my favorite lines from Canadian history, and Thomas D'Arcy McGee said it: there is room in this northern dominion under one flag and one set of laws for one great people. There is no possibility for that greatness if we succumb to 100 squabbling particularities. Lauren Gunter, thanks very much for joining us.
You bet. Anytime, bro.